Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. This is show number 100, and it's the second anniversary of the Inner Circle podcast. And to celebrate, we're bringing back my first guest, engineer Dennis Moody. Dennis was also on the one-year anniversary on episode number 50 as well. But first of all, let's talk about some things that are in the news this week. The first thing is Tidal, the streaming network that was purchased by Jay-Z last year, is in trouble. And it's in trouble for a number of reasons. The first one is they've basically fired all of their senior management. They fired the CEO towards the end of the year. And just recently, last week, they fired the COO, Chief Operating Officer, and the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer. Basically, they don't have any adults running the program right now. And that's bad for the service. Another thing that's bad is the fact that they just got sued for $5 million for non-payment of royalties. Now, this is really embarrassing for a streaming service that's owned by an artist, first of all, and is supposed to be extremely artist-friendly and more artist-friendly than any of the other services out there. So to be sued for non-payment of royalties, again, that's a big embarrassment. Another big embarrassment recently was Kanye West released his album, Life of Pablo, exclusively on Tidal. And it died a very quick death, mostly because no one listened. Matter of fact, there was some talk in the BBC last week about how it was pirated 50,000 times or more. So in fact, what ended up happening was, here Kanye West puts his album exclusively on his buddy Jay-Z's streaming service, and nothing happens. And then to make it worse, Nielsen comes to him and says, okay, why don't you give us the numbers so at least we can see where it's going to be at on the Billboard charts? And they refuse to give out the numbers. Now, why? Could have been that the numbers were pretty bad and they didn't want to be embarrassed yet again. But the real problem here is the fact that, boy, for a streaming network that's supposed to be artist-friendly, it's far from that. And this could really spell the end, or at least a big change in Tidal in the coming months. Now, already Jay-Z has talked about selling Tidal. The likely investor is Samsung, even though they already have a very similar site called Melk Music, which of course hasn't gained any traction either. So now here you have two services that haven't gained traction. The only thing that Samsung has is much deeper pockets, so we'll see what happens. But Tidal had so much promise a year ago and just has gone downhill ever since Jay-Z bought it. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. I just launched a new mini coaching program, and it's called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks. And I've also launched a new live mixing workshop where I'm going to personally help you with your mixes. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. That's bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Another thing in the news was some vintage gear that was found last week. And it started out with 10,000 vintage albums, vinyl albums, that were still sealed and still in their same packaging. A record dealer who owned a record store out of Minnesota actually found these in a basement in Texas, and he paid $100,000. Now, these date back to the 60s and 70s, so he paid basically 10 bucks an album, and he figures he's going to make a lot more, obviously. So $100,000 for 10,000 records. And these were records from like Prince and Bob Marley and the Ramones, and things that will probably get a good price on the open market. It just goes to show you that there's actually a lot of things that we think that we've found them all, and in fact, that's not true. Another example recently was 13 record presses that were found in a warehouse in Chicago. Again, record presses until recently hadn't been made in over 30 years, and everyone thought that they knew where every single one of them was, and here we find 13 of them that were covered up in a warehouse. Another example, talking about vintage guitars and amplifiers. Recently, again, a warehouse in Albuquerque, of all places, When it was closing, they found hundreds of vintage guitars, and we're talking things like Moserites and Fenders and things from the 60s and 70s that no one had expected. Why Albuquerque? Well, for a long time, that was a railroad stop that was the distribution center for all of the West Coast. So in other words, Gibson, who was in Chicago and in Nashville, they would ship out to Albuquerque. Albuquerque then would offload to their distributor, which would distribute to the West Coast. And the West Coast manufacturers, like Fender, for instance, and Moserite, which is another one, would ship to Albuquerque, where then it would be shipped to a different train to go to wherever else on the East Coast or the Midwest it was supposed to go. So this warehouse in Albuquerque was this hub, and everyone had forgotten about it, and suddenly they find all of these vintage guitars in their original cases, never played. Another thing I recently heard of was someone finding a couple of vintage Fairchild compressors. Where? Well, there was a radio station in the middle of Kansas, middle of nowhere, basically. An old radio station that hadn't upgraded its gear in 50 years, probably since it first started. And now it was just sold. The new owners were doing a complete refurb on it, and they're about to throw out these old vintage Fairchilds, which somebody found and bought them for a good price. Actually, the people that were selling them understood that there was some vintage value, but they still didn't charge the $25,000 that you have to pay on the open market these days. So these deals are still out there. Have I personally ever found any deals like this? Well, actually once. I was visiting a friend in Long Beach, California, and I happened to run into a percussionist that I hadn't seen in 15 years, maybe. And I played with him in a band only for a short while. Happened to run into him, and he said, "You know what? I'm selling some gear, and it was from my family's band. And we just want to get it out of the garage. You want to check it out?" So I go over, and wouldn't you know it, there's a Vox Continental organ. There's one of the older Fender basements with the big cabinet with JBL speakers in it, 15-inch JBLs. And there's a Fender Leslie. So I said, "How much do you want for it?" And he said, "Well, how about $300? And I immediately ran to the bank, got the $300 in cash, gave it to him, and did whatever I could to fit all that stuff in my car, which was not easy at the time. Within a week, I had sold the Fender Leslie for $750. I sold the Vox Continental for $800. And I kept the Fender basement, which I still use to this day. Actually, I kept the head and sold the cabinet. So that was quite a find. It was the only one that I've ever found like that. But I actually made money off of it, mostly because I didn't want the things that were there. I didn't want the Vox Continental, and I was never a big fan of the Fender Leslie, although there are those fans out there, which I found out immediately. There are all sorts of people that wanted to buy it. The point of all this is, yes, that stuff is still out there. You always hear the stories and you think this will never happen to me. But you know what? It just might. You just have to be on the lookout. Always look for that special deal. Always look for that vintage item. Because believe me, it's still there as long as you look for it. My guest today is engineer Dennis Moody, and he was my first guest on the Inner Circle podcast 2 years ago. He was also my guest on episode number 50, which was the one-year anniversary as well. So we're bringing him back for the two-year anniversary for episode number 100, and that's where we're at. Episode 100, and wow, it went really, really fast. Dennis is unique in that he is not only a great studio engineer, but he's also a really good live engineer as well. His clients include some of the best drummers in the world, like Steve Gadd and Dave Weckl, Michael White, among many, many others. I spoke with Dennis in his studio in Los Angeles. Here we are. This is episode 100. You're on number one. You're on number 50 at the one-year anniversary. Here's a two-year anniversary. Welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Looking for number 500.
Yeah, that'd be great, huh?
Yeah.
You've been all over the world the last year, and the year before, and the year before that,
the year before that, too.
What is the difference now in the audiences going from country to country or large city? Has it changed at all?
No, actually, I don't think it has. And that's really funny because when negotiating my tour rates with certain artists, or with all of them, actually, you know, they're saying it's really bad now. There's nobody coming. And I'm sitting in the middle of the audience on those shows. I see the last 15 years, I'm seeing the audience size is the same. The only difference is now instead of 20 euros, they're charging 25 euros. So I don't buy their logic. I'm thinking, you know, when negotiating my tour rates, I'm thinking that maybe the expenses have gone up, perhaps. But as for your question about the amount of people there, no, it's all. I don't see any big changes, especially for the jazz fusion artists I do.
Okay, but let's not talk about the number of people in the audience. I mean, the overall audience, the difference between them from city to city. How do you find those differences, the reaction?
You mean like going from Japan to Milan?
Yeah.
Oh, in Japan, they're very polite. They clap. They walk in very orderly in line. In fact, the first time I saw it, I was, what's going on here? You know, they let 50,000 people into the jazz festival, and I saw the sign, two and two, very orderly walking in, and very polite audience. They clap, they don't hoot and holler like they do in some of the Western countries, especially the States. The change from previous years is, I think it's all the same, but if you compare audience in, say, London, for example, they're pretty feisty and rowdy, you know, and they like to express their joy for the show and appreciation for the show. But they're pretty much all the same, except for that. It's social, it's a culturally,
yeah.
The difference I see.
Okay, so we kind of know what the state of the business, the music business is here, but you get a better view of it because you're all over the world.
Yes.
What is the state of the music business globally?
From what I see, record company, forget it. I don't believe in them anymore. In fact, I stopped believing in them quite a few years ago and changed the way I do my business. As an engineer and the artists I'm working for, I just refreshed my list of recent clients, and I'm kind of shocked. I go, wow, these are the top people in the world. But they're all independents. They aren't major label artists. Steve Gadd, Dave Weckl, Steve Smith, all these great artists, Randy Brecker, they do their own thing now. So it's hard for me to judge the large companies because I got out of that quick. I adjusted my rate, COD. You know, I don't have to wait 4 months to get money if I'm even going to get it. I don't have to renegotiate it after I did the work. And I found that starting to happen. And some of my engineer friends now, they spend 15, 20% of their schedule chasing down their money or getting, it's stupid. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to do this as a creative process of making records. This is the joy I get. So I don't want the business to get in the way. And I found that was happening with the majors, and I didn't want any part of it.
I keep on hearing from people that it's pushed out 6 months now.
Six months. And then at the end, they're waiting for their return, and they want to see return on that. And if they don't get it, they're going to say, well, we can't pay you. Yeah. I mean, I used to do wait months and months and finally said, look, let's take care of this bill. It's, you know, it's not that big. And they wanted to negotiate 50 cents on the dollar. And the last time I did it, and I won't say who the artist was or the studio, but it was a very big record. I mean, it's multi-platinum. And I said, okay, I'll take the 50 cents on the dollar. But someone made a math error. So I ended up with about 95 cents on the dollar. Didn't bring the math error to their attention. And that's pretty much the last time I did one of those bigger projects. So it's hard for me to judge the state of the record industry, legitimate record industry now, for small independents. Mm-hmm. Randy Brecker, for example, is doing his own. They have two or three records out on his own. It's his own label. Weckl does his own stuff now. Stern is on a label, Mike Stern. And it's kind of a drag because he's been, for 7 years, he was nominated for a Grammy. 7 years in a row. And I go, okay, eighth, he's going to get it too. But they dropped the category.
Oh.
So I sing, okay, here's one, another one we're going to have a shot at. But he's, I think he's repressed some of his old stuff where he's doing it himself.
Well, that's a good question for you. So how much do artists sell in terms of merch, in terms of CDs at the show?
That's a, okay, this is great. Stern is the king of it, and everybody knows it. It's kind of a running joke in the circle that we're in with the Jazz Fusion guys about Mike Stern and his CD sales. He hawks them, but I've seen him out. Well, I've seen, he usually sells about 50 a show, I think, from what I see. Sometimes he sells 20, sometimes he sells 100. We were in Sweden once, and he sold, I think, 200 or 300 at one gig.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Wow.
At one gig. Yeah, it's amazing. When I went out with Edgar Winter last year, we did a 2.5 week tour, and he got CDs, and they're, again, it's a re-release, self-released, older project that he has the masters, owns the masters on. He pressed them. They did 280, pressed up 280, and we did 12 shows, and we came back with 4 CDs left after it. So for him, and, you know, the first, I go, you know, if you want to sell these CDs, I'll help you. You've got to get out there and hawk them. You got to yell, hey, CDs, got CDs. And you might think it's kind of corny, but when you walk away selling 20, and you're going to be very happy.
What's he selling for?
We're doing 20 euros.
Okay, well,
20
well,
euros.
That's a
yeah,
good
but he signs them. And, you know, he goes, okay, well, I got to cool down a little bit. I go, Edgar, you got to be out there. Well, the notes are still ringing from the last song.
Yeah, right.
When they walk out, you have to be there. Yeah. So I got him. Got it very quickly, and he goes, oh my God, look at this. You know, the first show, we didn't do anything. I think he sold 3. And I go, let me help with this. And I think we sold 45 on the next show. And he saw that if he actually got out there and made it a part of his job, and he would sell.
Were these new releases or combinations?
They're old, old. It's an old, it's a re-release of an older CD that he had done 6-8 years ago, I guess. Yeah. Real nice stuff. But the point is, to make money these days, I think that's the way it has to be. You can't count on a company. The companies used to give you tours. Remember that?
Yeah,
the tour support?
Yeah, gone
a
long time ago.
Yeah, now, forget it. So you have to do it on your own, and you have to do merch. You know, T-shirts are ridiculous. They're too big to carry around unless you have one bag. And then, you know, I don't know if the return on them. CDs is the best. If you do your own, record it, especially with the jazz guys that I work with, you can do a record very quickly. You're still going to spend 20, 30 grand on it, though.
You know, I just had the guys from Manhead Merch on the show, and what was interesting about that is I thought they were just a merch company that makes it for you. But in fact, they were a licensing company that would take care of everything. And they basically said, okay, Edgar or whomever, Mike Stern, just sign here. We'll take care of the rest, including we'll set up the booth. We'll have a person on tour with you. And we'll just, in the tour, we'll just give you a check.
Really?
And it was like, this is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And they would even do the design.
They still
for
do
new
that.
Artwork. Yeah.
I see. About 2 years ago, for one of my artists, you came to a show.
Yeah.
They're looking for that. Yeah. And I called 5 companies, and they said, well, this is what it's going to cost you. And I go, wait a minute. I know that it's possible, especially with this particular artist, you know who I'm talking about, who has 5,000 to 12,000 people show up every show.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a great way. So after we're done here, please get me that contact. I'm going to call them tomorrow.
That's funny because, you know, there's a demarcation line of where merch suddenly becomes possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're just starting out, if you're in an artist or band, it's only been around for a couple, 3 years, something mm-hmm. like that. It's hard to sell merch and make a lot of dough. You can do it.
Yeah.
But if you hit the B or C level or something, then you can actually make some money on merch. It then becomes possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is that tipping point that you kind of have to hit.
That's true. And the licensing thing is pretty cool. I remember going out on tour with, I don't remember if it was the Cramps or one of those bands back there. I was mixing a few shows for, a friend of mine was playing drums for them, and they opened a show for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Mm-hmm. This is probably late 80s, I guess it would be. And Flea was there. Hey, Flea, how you doing today? He goes, I'm doing great. I go, good, good. He goes, you'd be doing great, too, if you just got a check in the mail for $1 million.
Yeah.
We just licensed our merch. And I said, wow, that's really cool. And I didn't know about the licensing thing. That was when it was just starting, where people would actually buy the rights to the merch.
It's not so much they buy it, they license it.
Right.
So... But now instead of getting 100%, you're getting 25 or 30%, but that's okay because they're taking care of everything else. So if you don't have to worry about dragging stuff along or even manning the merch booth,
That's a great way to do it. I think it's the key to making the business of being in a band and going on tour feasible. Edgar, for example, Edgar Winter, you know, he realized how much he was going to pick up by selling all those CDs. And we actually held some out for our last show, but we didn't sell as well CDs. The show did well, but they didn't buy in London. Our last show was in Paris. And sorry, we're out. We don't have any more. And I had held out 30, thinking London we'd sell them out, and we sold, we were four short. He took four home at the end. But it paid for all those extra expenses. You know, he hadn't toured over there in 8 or 12 years, and people forget, of course. Mm. So he goes, wow, this paid for all of the hotels that I was liable for and all the travel stuff. It almost paid for the tour bus.
Who's buying that stuff?
In his case, fans, you know, old fans.
They're older demographic.
Yes. His shows started at 40s, late 40s, up to 70s.
Yeah.
He had an older crowd. And, you know, they're pretty settled people in their lives, and they wanted to buy a CD, and they wanted a picture with them, and they wanted an autograph. You know, it's not like the younger kids who just say, well...
You know what's funny? Last night I went to a premiere of a movie. It was a short film done by Marriott.
Mm-hmm.
And it was marketed specifically to millennials.
Hmm.
And it was getting them familiar with their brand. It was kind of a comedy, humorous thing, but it wasn't hitting you over the head. Marriott, Marriott, Marriott. It was mentioned here and there. But you go into the screening room, and there was a CD on every chair.
Oh.
And I'm scratching my head. I'm thinking, okay, so what's this? And it was a soundtrack. And then later on, it kind of dawned on me that this was a way to appease the client, the artist, the producer, mm-hmm. saying, look, we're going to get your music out, other than having it just on the film. You know,
there's
a way, and even if only one person listens to it might be the right person.
That's true.
So it was really interesting. I don't know if that's the case. That's what I surmise.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they actually talked about it later, they talked about this thing, that mm-hmm. this piece of plastic that's on your seat.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it was kind of interesting. And again, you know, and Snoove, we worked on
right.
together. When they did their first album, I said, don't do any CDs. It's over, blah, blah, blah. They insisted.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we stopped. We held out. Couldn't get any reviews. Nothing happened until that CD was pressed. And as soon mm-hmm. as it came out, all of a sudden, it was official. They were official.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as people want to come down on CDs, there's something that...
I agree.
It's tangible.
I think they're here to stay, too. I think they're here because it's a piece of plastic in your hand, and you can have the artist sign it.
Yeah.
Here's an example. A friend of mine up in Toronto has just started a t-shirt company. It's called Jazzwear.
Mm-hmm.
give him a little plug here.
Yeah,
Don.
Good idea.
Well, what he does for his product, and it actually we came up with the idea together, but I don't have time to get into that with him. So he's run it, and it's actually starting to take off. It's a flyer, and you put it out on every table, every seat. You know, you sign your agreement with the artist, and then you put it out on every seat, every table at the jazz club or the venue. And what it is right now, if you want to take home a souvenir from the show, go on your phone, put this code in on our website, and place your order, and it'll be to you in 3 days.
Yeah.
Your T-shirt from this show specifically. And this way, they don't have to carry stock.
Yeah.
Here's what it looks like. And they're still excited about the show, the consumer, and they, oh, yeah, I want to get one of those.
It's easier than standing in line.
Yeah, and it's sold. And he said that they have Mark Egan as their first guy. He's a jazz artist, yeah. And they're having some success with that, just starting the company. He's been working on it pretty hard for about a year, and it's starting to take off. And he's got a couple other pretty big artists, especially the jazz fusion guys, that are extremely interested in doing it. So hopefully, hopefully it'll take off and it'll get me back involved, and I can sit there and wave my $1 million check around like Flea did.
It'd be nice, huh?
Yeah. Anyway,
let's talk about sound systems around the world. So you work with large sound systems and different venues, different large venues, especially different large cities, and small club systems. Mm-hmm. Well, let's just talk about the large systems. What is the difference that you find? Is there any difference when you go from country to country? And I know your writer states that there's certain things that you have to have.
Right.
Is there still a difference that you find?
Yes. Yes and no, but mostly not really. If it's a Line Array, JBL, Vertec, or whatever, some have their tonality is different, and I just go through my graphic EQ, and I get them to sound the way I need them to sound. Mm-hmm. I'm not so specific on that. Some have a warmer sound than others. D&B was the first large system when they were the German company before they started over here back in the 90s. I used them in large halls. One in Helsinki, Finland, we did a show in a 14,000-seater. It was an opera. So I just fell in love with those. Probably my favorite, but I'm not saying that the others are worse. Mm-hmm. There are some. I can't think off the top of my head that sound a little more plasticky and tinny. But basically, if you have enough power and enough overhead, you can get away with almost anything. It's the way it's configured for me that's the issue.
Ah, there's the question then.
Mm-hmm.
Do the system techs change?
You mean the...
Well, their philosophy.
No, it's all the same. It's the same. Okay. You have a line array hanging.
Yeah, but the guy that's putting the system together there.
No, actually, they're pretty much on the same wavelength now. They're pretty much, they all know about what it is. Some of them don't set it up the same. They, for example, if you have a speaker hang, you're going to find the bottom speakers, which are pointing down to the front rows, can't be as loud as the top speakers because they have to throw to the back of the hall.
Sure.
So I always start with those up 20% and down to the bottom, I maybe 40%, 50%. So you have to feather it down. And there is a formula for that. And one of my great techs here, Clark, who works for Anti-M Sound, he knows this formula. When I go in and he's teching or helping me set up a system, it's perfect. I don't have to do much. I have my specifics for the hang. Side hangs, which are extremely important, and with some of my artists in the bigger halls, and you were at that show.
That's right.
Oh, what are those people doing up there? Well, we had such a demand for tickets, we opened up 200 seats on each side of the stage. Well, that's nice, but there's no PA up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see what happens.
Yeah.
I'm insistent now. If there's seats up there, I make them cover them with black molten if they're closed, so people can't, you know. And if they're uncovered, they have to have sound. That's how I go. I say, I want those covered. Even if you take a 5-foot roll and roll it down the edge so people can't walk in there. Yeah. I don't want any open seats without sound coverage. Yeah. I walk around. I say, I can't hear back here. And don't worry, no one will be sitting up there. Yes, they will.
Yeah.
Then cover it, or I want it. So I adjust. I have side hangs. I have front hangs. And then my most important is the front fills. And everybody says I do overkill, but I'll tell you what, I haven't had a bad show since I started demanding more front fill.
Really?
And the way I do it is I put everything on a mono aux send post from the front of house. I put all the band in it. I put the vocal up 20% higher. And it's all mono, you know, if you're sitting 5 feet, 6 feet from the front of the stage and it's a 4-foot stage, you don't want stereo because you're not going to hear. So I put all the mono. I also put the side fills in mono because you want to hear everything. But the front fills, I do that way. And then when the band's up there playing and doing their sound check, I walk the front, and I have somebody at the back, and I have a walkie-talkie, or I'd say point and turn them up or turn them down to where the vocal is in the right place, sitting in the front rows. And that's how I do it. And before I go in, I cue everything, but until I actually hear a vocal coming through there, I won't know exactly what the ratio is.
Yeah, I get it.
And EQ, I'm very light on subs. I usually, the first thing I do is I go in and say, okay, turn the subs down 10 dB. We don't need those. And run your crossover a little lower on the tops.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I get down to about 80 on the crossover. I don't need it. In fact, sometimes I get lower on there if I can, but you know, the boxes it's don't hold
pet
it as
peeve
much
of mine that there's too much sub everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially at NAMM. Did you go to NAMM? You walk around NAMM, listen to those sound systems, it sounds like a subwoofer with the band.
Yeah, that's it. People want clarity, and you know, they don't want that. And especially when they're in the front, if you're sitting in front of the sub, you don't want to hear that overwhelming the sound. Now, of course, you're going to have that problem the way they are. They don't hang the subs. I wish that someone would come up with a system where the subs could be hung, but they're too big. So yeah, I don't think someone could come up with a box, you know, a line array sized box that can fit into the hang that was subs. It would really be cool because then you'd have your full spectrum of audio coming from one source, you know, and instead of having those subs under the stage.
But how much do you actually need the sub when it's all said and done? I mean, if you're turning it down that much, you're only getting just a very little bit, which I think is the right amount, personally.
Yeah.
But how much
it depends. And it depends what kind of music you're doing. Yeah. And in my case, I do real bands, natural sounding, and then I went to a Tool rehearsal for a show there, playing at some festival out in the desert and for 200,000 people, and they were doing a private dress rehearsal the night before, and I had to leave the room because the subs were shaking so much. And the same guy mixes System of the Down. He's a great guy, and man, was the mix awesome. And I talked to him about some of his drum miking techniques with Danny Carey, who's a friend of mine forever, you know. And I saw some interesting things that he was doing, but the subs, and that's the kind of music it is. People want to be just rattled with that kind of music.
Well,
mine, they don't.
Do they?
Or do they? Well, I didn't. I had to leave because it was disturbing. It was
shaking my
body.
Again, I think that's maybe a myth.
Could
be. It has to be busted.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I'd love to mix one of those bands and see. There's a way you can get that lows in there to give it power without killing people.
Yeah, sure.
Man. So, but anyway, back to your point of setups, you know, they're pretty consistent if they follow what I want. And if you get a good crew, you know, they'll take care of you. And the front fills, yes, I here's an example, the Nokia, now the Microsoft. I went in the first time, they had four front fills, and that's one of the widest stages in the U.S. I think it's 120 feet opening. I could be wrong, maybe it's 90, but anyway, it's very wide.
Yeah.
And they had four, and I said, we're going to need to take, I want two side stacks, full range side stacks. So let's take what we don't use side fills for this artist. I want you to put these side fills and point them into the audience, mm-hmm. so we fill up the front rows. And when I got there, the manager, production manager, said, "Oh, I talked to my. I go, where are these? Where's my side front? Where's my fills? Yeah. I only have these four. This isn't going to work." He goes, "Well, I talked to my sound guy, said you don't need that." And I go, "Oh, did they? Yeah. Okay." And I was going, "This isn't going to work." Well, after sound check, if you feel you need it, or during sound check, we'll put them up. I go, "You can put them up now because I know we're going to need them." He goes, "No, just try it." Sound check goes. And we have very quick sound checks with that artist. I need them. We don't have time now. So next time I went in, I said, "I want nine of them." They had four. I got nine. I had them end to end, 7 feet apart. 2.5 meters is it's on my rider.
Yeah.
People go, "That's too much." And I go, "You sit anywhere in the front row, you're going to hear it crystal clear." And it works for me. So I use nine now spread across. And if I go to a smaller width of a stage, like in Sydney, I was in Sydney recently, and the stage, for some reason, they left out about 8 feet of width. It worked. Everybody scrammed together, but I still had five or six of them up there, 7 feet apart, 2.5 meters, end to end, and it worked great. You know, it worked really well.
Geez, if you spend all that money to be in the front row, you should be able to hear pretty well.
And some of the artists charge a lot for front row. And I got complaints on that Nokia show. Too bad we couldn't hear in the front. And I just said, "Man, I told you." So I went in and said, "Don't even bring it up. Next time I come here, I'm doing this." And I'd been back twice since, and I get my nine fills, and it works great. And going back in May again, mm-hmm. and I'm already to go with, I want those nine fills. And it works so good, you know.
Changing the subject a little bit. Were you on the road when the Paris massacre happened?
Yes, I was in Stockholm, and it was the day before our first show for Edgar Winter's tour. And are we canceling? Are we canceling Paris? Are we canceling Belgium? What are we going to do? No, we're going to continue and see how it works. Actually, it's 2 days before, so. But the first show was kind of creepy. Yeah. Everybody's looking at the doors and stuff, and it got a little more relaxed. But then we went to Vivier, Belgium, which is a real hot spot for these crazy people, and that was a little nerve-wracking down there.
Did you go to Paris?
Yes, we did, 2 weeks after, and we were right down the street at the New Morning. But they had good security, but what's good security,
you know? Well, speaking of which, since then, have you found security has been heightened at shows?
Yes, absolutely. At least in Europe it was. I haven't seen any difference here.
Yeah.
Europe, much tighter. In New Morning, they had the doors shut. You had to come in a different way. They did have a metal detector up, but they didn't use it. But they searched everybody, patted everybody down as they're coming in. They used to have, the door would stay open. And they have big steel doors there, and they were shut, and you couldn't open it unless mm-hmm. you knocked. Once the bulk of the people were in, they'd shut the door. And they had extra security guards. They had four this time. Previously, they said one or two guys.
Yeah, yeah.
They doubled it up. Yeah, it was kind of tense the whole time.
How about traveling?
Traveling has always been just in and out of airports, always the same. Mm-hmm. They're pretty secure. But
so that didn't change it?
That much. Didn't change it. No, everybody's a little on edge, so they were a little edgier, but everybody was it's about the same. This, the airport security. Well, I go to Turkey all the time, and they just had someone blew a hole in a airplane.
Saw that, yeah, right in Somalia.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a scheduled Turkish airline flight, and they changed it to a different airline because they canceled the Turkish flight. So that was. They think that that was supposed to be a Turkish Air flight, which I fly on all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Going over there. So that's a little nerve-wracking. Some of the places I go are a little, you know, that's one of the reasons I want to stop. The world's just getting too crazy. You know, I don't want to do all these big tours all the time. Hotels are targets. Venues are targets. Concerts are targets, obviously.
Yeah.
But they've been... When I lived in Berlin in the 90s, Algeria, every time there's a concert in Algeria, they'd get whack the artist, you know, on the stage. So I it was coming here, and it did, and now everybody's aware. So, but it's pretty tense out there.
Well, it's a good reason to stay home, and luckily. You're an excellent studio engineer as well.
Thanks,
so it's not like somebody who all they do is they mix sound on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, that's different because now you're forced to go regardless.
Yeah. 9/11 got me. That got me big. I was in Europe and I had just moved back and I was touring and doing a lot of live stuff. And B.B. Winans, we were supposed to go to Durban on September 14th, 2001. And of course, that was canceled. I didn't work for about 14 months.
Yeah.
14 months, I had nothing. It was really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard. I mean, I was lucky.
Put the brakes on a lot, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Let's switch back to sound systems for a second.
Sure.
And let's talk about a philosophical question. Are sound systems better today than they were 20, 30 years ago?
Technically, yes. Conceptually, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I have this discussion with a lot of older guys out there. You know, when they had the stacks, you know, I used to go to the forum when I was a kid. So Led Zeppelin and Hendrix, they didn't have line arrays. They didn't have hanging speakers. Everything was stacked on the side of the stage.
And,
the reason they don't do that is because of the view.
Yeah.
You block out, if you're in a 10,000 seat arena and you're blocking out 2,000 seats because your speakers, that's bad business. So the line array conceptually is much better. You take everything off the floor, you know, so it's really great. But sonically, I'm not really sure if it is better. You know, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I can only imagine and try and recall what those sounded like back then.
Well,
but
all I know is the best concerts I ever heard back then were so far superior sound-wise to what I hear now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And most of it was because they used horn-loaded systems, horns all over the place, which is problematic in setup, as we know. It's not the easiest way to do it. But boy, the sound was good. I can remember going to Central Park and hearing a Gary Wright concert when he was hot at the time.
Yeah.
And it was like the record.
Yeah.
It was just so good. You could hear everything. You could hear his vocal. And I bet if you reproduced that today, it would be substantially different.
I'd sure like to try it. You know, in some of the clubs, we get those systems. You know, not everything is hung line arrays. You know, we get a lot of stacks and we get a lot of, you know, PAs sitting on the floor stacked up and some hung. My problem with the new system is if you're sitting 10 feet, 10 rows back, and you're looking at a singer singing in front of you, and you're hearing the sound coming 40 feet above your head, what is that? And Yoshi's San Francisco, a great club, and they really tried hard. It's done. It's closed. You know, and they
had... Is it? I didn't know.
Yeah, it's done.
Oh.
No, that's all finished now. They tried to turned into a pop club, and they had the restaurant was great, the staff was great, the service was great, and I remember Bernie Kirsch, who's Chick Corea's first guy in there, and I called him and I said, hey, we were the second people in with Mike Stern, Dennis Chambers, and Victor Wooten band, and I go, okay, this has to be right. And I called Bernie and I said, hey Bernie, can you give me some tips on how's the venue? He goes, oh man, it's beautiful. Go, well, how's the PA? Oh, the staff is great. The food is great. Well, how's the PA? Because You'll see. And I go, oh, okay. And when we went in there, there was nothing, you know, what they did is they set up, they had 80% of the people on the floor and 20% on the balcony. Yet they had 90% of the PA for the balcony and 10% for the floor.
Oh.
And I'm going, who designed this setup? This is wrong. You can fix this very easy. This is what you need to do. You need to drop the bottom two boxes to where they're just over. See that door over there? It says exit, fire exit. So that the bottom one is about 6 inches above that door on both sides, and you'll solve this problem. And they never did it. And they always had sound complaints over there, and they never got it right. Had they got it right, and people would say, oh, I want to go there because the sound's great, you know, and I always enjoy it. But every time I go there, the sound is bad.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, that's...
But that being said, you can't be too picky about venues anymore because there's not that many of them. So good sound, bad sound, I think you're going regardless if somebody wants to hire you.
True. Well, yeah, in most cases.
Yeah.
But you get people in our business going, there's a... The Catalina Jazz Club. It's the best club in LA for, and people are trying to take it down. You know, they're opening other clubs and expanding, and they just can't. She's it, and she's the landmark jazz promoter in this town, and you know, that's fantastic. And they have 100% of my support. Yet, you know, PA is a little questionable over there, you know. And Line 6, they make a great product. They put it in there for them as a demo. It's just not really working in that venue, you know.
It's a Line 6 PA.
It's a Line 6 PA.
Okay, so it's one of those that they tried to release. They put a lot of time and effort into
that. And bless them. You know, I'm glad they're trying, and I really appreciate that they put it in there, but it's plastic. You know, the boxes are plastic, and it doesn't really... I'm trying to find... I think plastic resonates around 3K, 3 to 4K, and that's the one that kills your ear. Get a lot of feedback. I did talk to somebody when I was over there with Dave Weckl's acoustic band. Two guys came in, and they're sound engineers, acoustic engineers. Yeah. I didn't get their names, but they're sitting in the back. And I said, you know, if you go up, the way it's configured, it's, you know, please walk around before you critique the mix. And I always get great reviews over there. Everybody I know that goes there often, they always tell me that they'd never heard it that good. And okay, after so many times, I do believe them, and I have the way I do it. Mm-hmm. And but I wish they said that they... Oh yeah, back to the point. They said if there's a way to fix that with those boxes, because you put padding over the back of the boxes so that it doesn't resonate, and you get a cleaner sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking of calling Line 6 because I really want that to work, and their product is good. It's just, it needs to be fine-tuned. Maybe heavier box would be great if they made them out of wood. It might change everything.
Of course, it'd probably be a lot more expensive too, so
but
therein lies the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem. The sound and does affect people coming. People say, I just can't go there anymore. There's places I wouldn't work at because of sound. One, the closed Lavalie, I loved that place.
Yeah.
But every time you really crappy PA, and you'd go in there and you'd get sound one place great, and it would be terrible somewhere else in the room.
Yeah.
Get it right for that point. And I said, I just can't work here anymore. It's counterproductive.
When you play at a venue, let's say a small venue, you're going out with Stern or somebody like that, Weckl, and you play in a venue 1 year, how likely is it that venue will be there the next year?
In Europe, because of the demand for this kind of music, it's going to be... they'll be there. They'll continue to be there. Yeah. I wonder, I'm not sure, but I think they get support. They get government support, cultural support, which we don't get here. Jazz club here asks money from the arts. Forget it.
Well, you hear what they're doing in London? They're losing so many venues that the mayor of London actually formed a task force to keep the existing ones still standing.
Wow.
And he had a wide variety of people on the task force that went from performers to tech people to, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it was the thing where there was two big ones, and I can't think of what they are, that closed over the last year to kind of scared the pants off of everybody. Mm-hmm. So they're doing their best to keep the tradition going.
That's good. With smaller venues? Or
all sizes.
Yeah.
All sizes, yeah.
Well, I can't imagine Royal Albert Hall closing or Wembley. Well, yeah. Ronnie Scott's, it's always sold out.
Yeah.
But Ronnie Scott's is different. It's a jazz club. You're a member, so you have to buy a membership.
Oh,
so
I see,
they have a built-in audience, but yet they have to still pay. But you have to be a member to buy a ticket.
But see, there's two reasons, though, that kind of go beyond how many people you have. Well, in one situation, no. First of all, it's... if the price of real estate is so high that you can make a lot more money
at the parking lot.
Well, no, not more, a lot more money in something else there rather than a club. Well, that's one way you'd go. And the other thing is, if you're getting big crowds, usually there's a lot of noise and neighbors complain.
True. Yeah.
So those are the things that are kind of against clubs right now that people are rebelling against.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I think most of the, like I was saying, most of the European clubs, the New Morning will be there. All the places in Europe, Sweden will be there because they have the built-in audience for them to be there.
Yeah.
Here, I don't know. There was the Trolf in Buffalo, which was a great jazz club. It actually did close for a while, but it's back open again. Ronnie Scott's got bought, so it's a new company that owns it, but that'll always be there. Catalina's, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if they'll be around. I know she'll do it. She'll figure out a way because she's got that drive and ambition. But some of they keep dropping.
Hey, it's just like everything else in the business. You got to love it.
Yeah.
Or else you'll make more money doing something else. You know, there's that passion involved.
Well, Spaghettini's opened Beverly Hills, and they started in there with the ultra high price, very high level and high level tickets, and down. They're back competing, same prices and stuff. Didn't work.
Yeah.
I hope they're there. I want all these venues to be there. But as you see, they close.
Yeah.
Not there anymore.
Well, cool. Thanks for being on show one, show 50, show 100. And hopefully we'll do 152.
I'm here.
As well, next year.
Not going anywhere. Well, I have to do a couple things coming up, little tours and stuff, short ones, one offs. Stern, maybe in November. But usually with him right now, I have two tours booked. But I'm trying to stick around and get this nice studio back in the swing, and it's going booked up solid for the next couple of weeks. So
very cool,
it's pretty good.
So. It certainly is in this day and age.
Yeah, we'll see. Anyway,
well, cool. I always know how to get you, even if you're on the road. So.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks for having me. Okay, see you next time.
To learn more about Dennis, you can go to dennismoody.com. Dennis Moody, all one word. Moody is M-O-O-D-Y, dennismoody.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. And speaking of thanking people, if it wasn't for Steve, the Inner Circle podcast would not exist. He was the person that actually got me to do this in the first place. So many thanks, Steve. And any congratulations also are due to you as well. And we share them both. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyownercircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyownercircle.com, you find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I will see you next time for episode 101.